Hello, this is Andy Bommack, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the April 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about Kim Deal, who is a singer for the Pixies, the Breeders, and the Amps. Also, a review of Who Believes in Angels by Elton John and Brandi Carlile. An obituary of the last member of the band, Garth Hudson, who died January 21st of this year. And a classic album review of Texas Flood by one of my favorite guitar heroes, Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I'm beginning today's program with the article about Kim Deal, the lovable sprite of the Pixies, the Breeders, and the Amps. It's taken Kim Deal nearly 40 years of music making, plus rehab, bereavement, and lockdown, to deliver a solo album. Now she's touring it. What kept her? It takes me a long time to like a song, she tells Grayson Haver Curran. Kim Deal is eager to talk about her first six decades, how her teenage performances with twin sister Kelly led to a lifelong collaboration, how her Fractions first band, Pixies, helped expand indie rock scope, how her second band, The Breeders, inverted the genre gender ratio. She especially wants to unpack Nobody Loves You More, the pinballing November 2024 album that marked her proper solo debut at age 63. People are always thinking, where's she been, says Deal, welcoming Mojo into the little brick bungalow she bought in her hometown of Dayton, Ohio, from the windfall of the Pixies' Doolittle. Well, I released another album and created another band, and now I'm doing something else. I've been busy. But first, Deal needs to open the mail in her final days of 2024, Greg Norman, a lifetime engineer at the late Steve Albini's Electrical Audio Studio in Chicago, dropped by Deal's place for a night of board games on his way to a family holiday. He left behind a sealed cardboard box, which she finally slices into this morning with a grin of anticipation. She lifts a metallic rectangle from inside and raises both hands in triumph. It is, she explains, a Normaphone preamp. Greg makes these, she says. Steve recorded me a bunch with this, and I always liked how it sounded with my voice. Now I can use it at home by myself. More than her velveteen rasp, esoteric but poignant lyrics, or uncanny song structures, no thread has perhaps been more consistent through Deal's career than the desire to make music herself, or at least in her own peculiar fashion. This new piece of gear offers another opportunity to do just that. Just minutes later, she dashes down the basement stairs, flipping through rows of tape machines and recording consoles she's employed to capture her ideas, since she was a teenager. She races back up two flights, pausing only long enough to show off the studio cables tucked inside a bathroom laundry chute, allowing signals to pass through the house. To show off still more equipment, detailing each bit's faults and features. For her, it has all served what may be her only overarching goal. I am just trying to get some noises to come out of the speaker that sound fucking good, she says, smiling. If I can do that, great. Making Nobody Loves You More, however, required Deal to learn a completely new skill set as she neared 60. Days after burying her mother in Ohio in February 2020, she returned to a vacation cabin on Florida's Summerland Key, where the pandemic marooned her for 4 months with an ocean view and an unfamiliar digital recording rig. She got to work, unlocking new inspirations and, in turn, the core of her solo debut. Her creativity and energy haven't tapered since I first met her. The appetite to go after it, to just get something recorded, says Norman, who first met Deal around 1999, when she was recording the Breeders' album, titled TK with Albany. She also has the energy to change things. If it isn't working, she'll just start over. Down in Florida, there was no master plan, no conceit. She just played and wrote. But Deal knows that time is at a premium. Since the 2018 release of the Breeders' All Nerve, both her parents and an aunt died. After nearly 40 years of work and friendship with Deal, Albany passed in May. Nobody Loves You More was one of the final records he engineered. I work at a slower pace, she says several hours later, bouncing on the balls of her feet, then shrugs, but I'd like to get going. In January 2003, Ed and Ann Deal picked Kim up at Halzadon, a rehab center in Minnesota, to live with them. Sister Kelly had been to Halzadon a decade earlier after being arrested for heroin possession. Kim had long fended off questions about her own drug habit. I've gone through my periods of chronic use, she told Spin, of heroin and hard drugs in 1995, but it was never an acute problem. But soon after, the Breeders released titled TK in the spring of 2002. Kim, nearing 41, began hatching a plan to check into Halzadon around Christmas. As the music industry entered its seasonal torpor, in a piece called The Addict Family, Kelly had already told The Guardian she suspected her twin had her problem too. Chemicals were already losing their shine for Kim anyway. I couldn't get drunk enough, and I couldn't get high enough, she remembers now. That was the thing. If it was still working, I would have still been doing it. During the 10-hour drive southeast to Dayton, Deal's parents told her that her mother had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. At first, it seemed far off, more like a prognostication of what might happen to her mother than a diagnosis of what was already happening. It took a while to see. Oh, that's a weird thing she just did, she says. But it divulged itself more and more. Deal had dealt with this as a teenager. Her parents had moved to Dayton from West Virginia, where her mother had grown up in a coal mining camp, and her father had lived in a shack with newspaper for wallpaper. They were always trying to outpour each other, she says. But Dad gave it to Mom in the end. Her mother's father, Hobart, eventually moved in with a family of five, and Kim now believes he struggled with undiagnosed Alzheimer's too, before he died from black lung disease. He would greet her with mornin' no matter the time of day. In her 40s, sober and back in Dayton with her elderly parents, Deal could feel her age settling in too. Taking care of Mom and the house with my dad, Buddy's doing the yard work, she says, smiling slyly. Watch your gardening or you'll throw your back out. Deal seemed farther removed from rock star trappings than ever, but just as she readjusted to Ohio, Pixies guitarist Joey Santiago called with an unexpected plea. His kid, Deal says, was moving to a different school district and he needed money. Could the Pixies reunite? In the late 80s, the Pixies had helped reinvigorate punk's weary body due to, in large part, to the scintillating vocal tension between Charles Thompson, under the name Black Francis, and Deal, credited as Mrs. John Murphy, her soon-to-be ex-husband. They sounded enormous and enigmatic, delightful and deranged. Anything other than complete satisfaction doesn't come into it. Ended Roy Wilkinson's rave review of Surfer Rosa in Sounds. Come on, Pilgrim, let's surf. And here's a little bit of the song Bone Machine from the album Surfer Rosa by the Pixies. Since their 1992 split, though, Deal had seen the Pixies as a beloved niche band, an act that influenced real rock stars like Kurt Cobain, but was never itself, well, gigantic. That shifted after the hit 1999 movie Fight Club, which Deal has still never seen, included Where Is My Mind in its final scene. And here's some of that song, Where Is My Mind, by the Pixies. If anybody in the States asked me what band I was in, And I said, the Pixies. They would say, oh, so it's an all-girl band? She says, but Fight Club changed everything because that song began to mean so much more. She'd heard whispers from managers that festivals had made lucrative reunion offers, but they'd gone nowhere. I didn't want to do it, she says, pausing a long time to stare out the window and tease out why. The Breeders had put out Title TK. I went to rehab, went back to my parents' house. I hadn't seen these guys in 10 years. For me, there was no interest. But when Santiago asked, she assumed they were doing a handful of gigs, not years of touring. I caved in on the phone call, fucking immediately, she says, howling with laughter and maybe regret. In my mind, we were just doing a couple of festivals. On and off for the next decade, Deal was a Pixie again. Despite her reunion reluctance, Deal enjoyed being back in the band for a long time. All the crowds knew all the songs. They were regaled as celebrities in spots they'd never seen, like Croatia and New Zealand. The quartet sounded brawny, and deferring to Deal's nascent sobriety, the band kept clean. Everyone is really together, Black Francis told Mojo in 2005. No one's drunk, no one's high, everyone's very on top of it. The urge to do something else, though, had never been faded. She and Kelly released The Breeders' Mountain Battles in 2008, and in 2013, not long after, she issued the first solo 7-inch in a series of 5, she announced she was stepping away from the Pixies. This was, she insists, the first time she left. I don't know why people think I broke up the band. Charles did to go solo. They had played Doolittle and loved it. They had even completed a Lost Cities run, visiting smaller markets they'd missed. But making new music with this old act didn't seem like the way forward. In my mind, she admits, it had run its course. What's more, she now had another legacy to tend, a reunion of the Breeders' classic lineup responsible for 1993's Last Splash. She admits it could seem like a low-risk cash-in on the heels of another, but this felt profoundly personal. Bassist Josephine Wiggs hadn't played on a Breeders album since Last Splash, and Deal hadn't worked with drummer Jim McPherson since their friendship ruptured during a tour with the Amps. Her attempted mid-90s solo project that ballooned into a full band. I went downstairs after an Amps tour, and his drums were gone. Like good alcoholics, we never spoke about it, she says. I regret that, but I can't change it. So that was a fucking big deal. The Breeders' reunion was another coronation, celebrated with a box set, magazine covers, slots at enormous festivals, all pointed reminders that they had always been much more than the introductory oohs and indelible licks of their anthem, Cannonball. And here's a little bit of that song by the Breeders, Cannonball. extended the anniversary run by adding Pod, their 1990 debut, to the set list. By the close of 2014, when they opened for Neutral Milk Hotel at the Hollywood Bowl, they were already writing and rehearsing new material in Dayton. By 2018, The Breeders, The Deals, again with Wiggs and McPherson, had finished a new album, All Nerve, largely alongside Albany and Norman in Chicago. It was the first time Norman showed her how to use Pro Tools, which would become her digital lifeline during her Florida exile. The Breeders' reunion then was not just a victory lap for Deal, it helped her find a new way forward. In early May 2024, Deal woke up to an emergency text, "Kim, call me." The command came from Tim Midyet, the former Silkworm bassist who, like Albany, had left Montana to become an indie rock mainstay. Midyet told Deal that a heart attack had killed Albany overnight. She paced around her home, telling Midyet this wasn't possible. He was, after all, 13 months younger than she was. "It's a weird way of not letting the information go in the brain," she says, frowning. "Like you're not letting it come in." Deal first met Albany late in 1987 on the way to Q Division in Boston to record Pixies' debut full-length LP, Surfer Rosa. The only thing she knew about him was Big Black's recent cover of Wire's Heartbeat. Sent over by 4AD head Ivo Watts Russell. She liked those guitars, and as they listened to cassettes in the car with Urge Overkill's Nash Kato, she realized she liked Albany too. "He was Chicago, Midwest, and I was Ohio," she says. "He just looked like a normal dummy." He became, she says, family. She and Kelly covered Dolly Parton with ukuleles at his 2009 wedding to Heather Wina. Less than two decades later, she played Breeders songs at his memorial service at Wina's request. "I was not surprised Kim and Steve stayed so close because they have a lot in common in terms of how seriously they take things," says Slint drummer Britt Walford, who drummed on Pod. They were both deep thinkers. Still, their relationship endured ups and downs. Not long after, she again stumbled upon Albany's infamous 1991 editorial in underground rock zine Forced Exposure, in which he eviscerated albums he'd helped make. "The actual record is nothing special," he wrote of Pod, "but I have a much deeper understanding of the twin phenomenon of synchronomious minces and breast swelling." Deal does not mince words. "Fucking bullshit. That was bad form. He's a little piece of shit for doing that, and I can imagine no one wanting to hire him again because he's a little fucking wiener," she says, waving her arms with every syllable. "And who gives a shit if Albany likes your band? He loves Cheap Trick and Bill Withers. He's not Mr. Taste Maker." They were friends long enough for her to watch him grow as a person, particularly after Wina helped convince him words had the power to harm. He realized he didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings unless they were proselytizing Steely Dan. And he was there at the birth of Nobody Loves You More, when Deal showed up at Electrical Audio with a hard drive of her digital recordings, presumed to be verbatim in Albany's analog world. He didn't complain. They just got to work. He was happy to do it, she says, wistfully, just happy to help. Together, Albany and Deal re-recorded many of the sounds she'd stitched together on her demos, recruiting 24 musicians to help. All these years later, he still dazzled her, the way he could capture an orchestra in a single take, on one track, or disco drums on another. After Deal thought she was done, she wrote one more song, A Good Time Pushed. At her label's request, she thought about how indie rock singers used to sound pinched by the instruments around them, as if they were trying to squeeze through their own band. Albany helped overturn that aesthetic. And here's that song by Kim Deal, A Good Time Pushed. When they were teenagers, Kim and Kelly played a lot of gigs in Dayton. Kelly would sing Bette Midler ballads, The Rose, at weddings, or they'd place their own PA system atop their grandfather's borrowed toilet chair in restaurants like Joe's Is a Fish House. But Kim never considered it a job, that it could become her adult source of income. I always thought I would do music and have a job, she says, her brow furrowed after a series of contemplative pauses. At no point did I ever think I was going to make a life in music, a career. Deal, though, last had a job that wasn't music in the spring of 1988, when she finally left her post as a so-called Kelly girl in a Boston doctor's office to head out on the Pixies' first overseas tour. Her employers were supportive, clipping local show advertisements from the weekly paper or saying they'd heard her on the radio. But it was clear something was changing. She now has two houses, the bungalow that doubles as her studio and a reliquary of tour posters and fan infirmaria, and another nearby that's largely devoid, she says, of reminders of the last 38 years. Even now, Deal repeatedly balks at the phrase professional musician, scrunching her nose like it's a foul odor. I try to be professional, she says, grinning again, but it just adds a bit of assholeness, you know. It's a loaded word. The hesitancy stems, at least in part, from Deal's perpetual lack of strategy and her pride in it. She loves to lampoon the idea of a proverbial 5-year plan and how, if she lived in New York rather than Dayton, she might actually have one. I would have a big picture, she says, spreading her arms wide. But those are things I don't find engaging. Nobody Loves You More resulted more from happenstance and circumstance than some vision to make a solo debut. Her hope to make some singles morphed into the idea of an EP, which morphed into a full-length patchwork of styles and sounds, from twilight country waltzes to surging indie rock stomps. She's read some of the reviews and is glad people enjoy it. It's not like I put out metal machine music. My God, I can't believe they like this racket, she says. Here's a little bit of the song, Nobody Loves You More, from K. Kim Deal's album titled The Same.
I just stop at the sight of you standing there.
But she's not sure she'll ever make another solo album. Sure, she hopes to write more songs, maybe get around to that EP, but she's never been someone to sit down and methodically work each morning. Attempts to be that deliberate have mostly led to songs she didn't love, like the Amps' She's a Girl, 30 years ago. I could get enough songs together for an album by Friday, she boasts, nearing noon on a Thursday morning. But I want to like them and keep being able to play them afterwards and enjoy that. It takes me a long time to like a song. Deal speaks often of her age, especially relative to her late family. Her mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in her 60s, and her grandfather's mind seemed gone in his early 70s. When she loses her train of thought, or gets lost in dates and details, she'll exclaim, "Past, paste," because that's what her forgetfulness feels like. She worries she inherited the la-la gene, she says with a wry chuckle. Well, I'm at the retirement age, basically. If I was going to be to an office every day and doing something I didn't love, I would take a pension, she says. But this is my business, so I'm retiring from my own business? That doesn't seem right. She pauses, then looks up and beams. Not even close to death would I get a song done quicker, though. I only have a month. Well, I'm never going to get that done. Okay, now I'm going to move on to the review of the much-talked-about album with Elton John and Brandi Carlile, titled Who Believes in Angels? It's not always reflected in his output, so it still raises eyebrows. But for decades, Elton John has been alone amongst his megastar peers in actually hearing and then championing new music. Such is his yen for transfusions of new blood. That when, in 2009, up-and-coming Elton John maven Brandi Carlile asked him to contribute to her Tumbleweed Connection-esque album track, Caroline, he made the acceptance call himself. The pair reunited in 2021 on the John-penned lockdown Sessions track, Simple Things. Fast forward to 2025. Elton John is still Elton John, but Carlile is a Grammy festooned commercial powerhouse of new country and Americana, and they've gone all in. John enticed producer Andrew Watt, Simple Things co-writer and producer, fresh from the Rolling Stones' Hackney Diamonds. In turn, Watt recruited past Chili Pepper Josh Klinglhoffer, present Chili Pepper Chad Smith, and bassist Pino Palladino. More surprisingly, Bernie Taupin agreed to contribute lyrics, which Carlile would edit, and edit lyrics, which Carlile had contributed. Recorded against a backdrop of John's eyesight issues, the sessions were tempestuous. But Who Believes in Angels is a collaboration of equals, a career highlight for Carlyle and a reunification for John, at something of a loose end, albums-wise, for a decade. The lengthy opener, The Rose of Laura Nyro, takes over 2 minutes before the vocals kick in. Their timpani, swirling synthesizer, reminiscent of John's work with Panau, a fearsome guitar solo, massed choral humming of John's stately piano. By any yardstick, it's a magnificent beginning, and the song continues in earworm fashion, with Carlyle and John harmonizing. As they trip through Nero's New York, while evoking her Eli and the 13th Confession album, "Eli's coming," hollers John, while Carlyle extemporizes like, well, Laura Nyro. Here's a little bit of that song, The Rose of Laura Nyro, by Elton John and Brandi Carlyle, from their new album, Who Believes in Angels?
Perform in Central Park, your master's word disguise, the sun inside the tide, it's a poison tender pushing, lay your head to rest upon the pale and purple cushion, like Virginia to the lighthouse, see the songbirds in the cages, the rose of Laura Nyro, shed its petals on the page.
It's the obvious standout, but there's much more. A rebooted Never Too Late is familiar from John's recent Disney documentary of that name, To Hell with Heaven's Gate, is now the less Disney-friendly Fuck Off Heaven's Gate, but Little Richard's Bible is a stomper of Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting ilk, and tellingly, Smith borrowed the actual Goodbye Yellow Brick Road drum kit from Ben Stiller for the pensive yet euphoric title track, where Carlyle asked, "What does it cost to buy your soul back when you die?" That's not the only contemplation of mortality. Sparse, echo-drenched, piano-led, and with a mournful brass coda. When This Old World Is Done With Me, clearly Taupin's work feels like a man mulling over his inevitable demise. Scatter Me Amongst the Stars, and is moving without being saccharine. If this is the closing song on Elton John's closing album, don't make bets though. He's exiting with self-awareness and dignity. Of that song, When This Old World Is Done With Me, by Elton John and Brandi Carlyle.
I don't want for nothing. I've been all right. I've been okay. I've been fine. I've had clouds with silver linings, complicated mornings, love that left me wanting, and hearts that changed my mind. I can feel the cold front. I've been chilly, I've been frozen, I've been warm. I felt sympathy and silence, helping hands and guidance, happiness and anger since the day that I was born. When this old world is done with me, just know I came this far to be broken up in pieces. Scatter me among the stars. like an ocean wave. Return me to the tide.
Okay, there's a significant passing to note. The last member of the band, Garth Hudson, left us on January 21st. Friends and collaborators remember him as genius, eccentric, cool. In the waning days of the 1960s, Benmont Tech went to see B.B. King at a three-day rock festival at a Miami racetrack. The enthusiastic piano player had turned 16 3 months earlier and was just beginning to experiment with the Farfisa organ. When he started to leave his festival seat for a drink that day, a new sound stopped him where he stood, the tone and technique of organist Garth Hudson during an uncanny performance of the band's I Shall Be Released. In the second verse, Garth draws up a sound so swell and moves between a few chords. It riveted me, remembers Tench, who joined Tom Petty in Mudcrutch 3 years later. The way he plays against the melody, against that miraculous voice of Richard Manuel. It was one of the most moving musical experiences I have had. And here's a little bit of that song, I Shall Be Released, by the band.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shine.
For the last 60 years, such rhapsodic accounts of Hudson, the ever-inquisitive multi-instrumentalist who elevated the band beyond its ramshackle bar band origins, adding a classical rigor and expansive musicality that forever pointed rock and roll in new directions, could almost seem standard. Robbie Robertson once wrote that Hudson could have been playing with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra or with Miles Davis. Levon Helm added the Grand Ole Opry to that hypothetical roster and noted that the older, better-trained Hudson made the band and its percussors unstoppable. Hudson died in a nursing home in Kingston, New York, on January 21st, the last surviving member of the band. He was 87. Music framed Hudson's Ontario childhood. His uncles had their own group. While his scientist father, Fred, was a saxophonist, flautist, and percussionist who welcomed his son's musical curiosity. His mother, Olive, played piano and a little soprani accordion, which her only child took to early. Hudson began studying piano at 7, attending a Toronto conservatory while learning hymns for services at a family funeral home. In high school, he even transcribed big band arrangements for his teacher, who then played the pupil's work with his own group. Alan Freed's radio show Moondog convinced him how much fun music could be. Still, Hudson didn't consider a career in bands. He wanted to work like his father in agriculture. Despite modest success with the early rock act Paul London and the Capers, he was intimidated by the invitation to join Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks. the group helm said, Hudson made unstoppable after he reluctantly enlisted. Nobody could follow him, including Elvis, Hudson once said of Hawkins. He didn't think he had the oomph the rowdy crew required, but they lured him with a Laurie Festival organ, a powerful alternative to the day's popular Hammond B3. Built with nearly 100 tubes and internal speakers, and a stipend to become his fellow member's music teacher. Hudson later demurred when asked how he actually taught them, but his lessons were clear enough in his playing. He supplied necessary nuance for Bob Dylan's infamous electric tours, then indulged Dylan's post-crash experimentation in the basement of Big Pink. As tender on I Shall Be Released as he was on Boisterous on Chest Fever, Hudson forever helped the band find new seams of sound from a seemingly boundless pool of influences, encompassing Dixieland, Zydeco, gospel, and his beloved Bach, who he continued to regard as a lifelong mentor. He expanded rock's horizon by broadening its musical base. Hudson's career after the band was at times tumultuous. Almost exactly 2 years after the Thanksgiving farewell that became The Last Waltz, he and his wife, Maud, lost their studio and home in the Agora Malibu fire. Sporadic session work on marquee albums, The Heartbreakers' Southern Accents, Nora Jones's Feels Like Home, Robertson's solo efforts kept Hudson active through the decades. When Hudson flew to London to open for Mercury Rev, he even carried a brown suitcase stuffed with such sheet music. Grasshopper remembers him practicing polkas by himself. Hudson was, in the end, as much a lifelong student as a teacher. The wellspring of his imagination that he suggested needed to be replenished always. You must, after the age of 33, continue to do a certain type of work, or else go into the shoe business, he told Ruth A. Spencer in 1983. Of the need to keep learning. Forget music, and it'll turn into hatred, or else reiteration, redundancy, and in many cases, death. And the classic album review this week is one of my favorite albums by possibly my all-time favorite guitarist, Stevie Ray Vaughan. The album, Texas Flood. Texas Flood put Stevie Ray Vaughan's uncanny talents on display for the masses. This album will attract everyone from the hardened bluesmen and casual fans of guitar and the blues. Texas Flood is a tremendous achievement for a new artist at the time of its release. By now, everyone knows about Stevie Ray Vaughan and his impact on modern music and his inspiration to many six-string enthusiasts. But at the time of Texas Flood's release, Vaughan was relatively unheard of except to the local club scene and a couple of high-profile collaborations. To someone new to SRV and the blues, and the album's sound is extremely polished. This lack of grit, however, does not take away from the emotion of SRV and his music. I also believe the polished sound lends itself well to Vaughan's soulful voice, which sometimes goes unnoticed, held up next to his guitar playing. Now to what put Vaughan on the map, his guitar. That is his claim to fame and probably is the reason you are even checking Vaughan out in the first place. Here's a little bit of a song you might be familiar with, Pride and Joy by Stevie Ray Vaughan off of his album, Texas Flood. Mm-hmm.
clever boy. Pride and joy. She's my sweet little baby. I'm my little lover boy. Yeah, I love my little. She's long and lean. You mess with her, you see a man get mean. She's my sweet little thing. She's my pride and joy.
Man, I absolutely love that song. Vaughn not only shows his playing ability, but also his talent for arranging and choosing his songs. This mixture of songs is deeply entrenched in the tradition of the blues, but they may also have a mainstream sound. Love Struck Baby and Pride and Joy are perfect examples of this radio-friendly pop sound. And here's a little bit of the song, Love Struck Baby, by Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Well, I'm love struck, baby, I must confess. Life without you, darling, is a silent mess. Thinking about you, baby, gave me such a thrill. I gotta have you, baby, can't get nothing. I love you, baby, and I know just what to do. I still remember, let it be said, the way you make me feel, don't take a fool to forget. I saw a ton of bricks that hit me in the head, and watched you do. Every time I see you make me feel so fine. Heart beating crazy, my blood running wild. Loving make me feel like a mighty, mighty man. Love me, baby, and I your man. I'm a love-struck baby. Yeah, I'm a love-struck baby. You got me love-struck baby. And I know just what to do.
The album, as a whole, contains a wide collection of soulful and grand guitar solos and Vaughn's trademark blues turnarounds. Double Trouble provides excellent rhythm to allow Vaughn to explore what sounds and feelings he can create with his guitar. The album also includes a few covers from Howling Wolf and Buddy Guy that help tie it to some classic blues players. For me, the highlight of this album is the track Lenny. Vaughn's use of solos and different tempos truly stands out among the other tracks. And here's a little bit of that song, Lenny, by Stevie Ray Vaughan. Easily accessible to new listeners and the non-blues listening crowd, though some of the instrumental and heavier blues-themed songs may be skipped over by the casual listener, it is still a must-listen for people who enjoy musicians at their best. Overall, Vaughn shows that the modern generation still craves and respects the blues and can continue to add to the traditions. And let's hear a little of the song Mary Had a Little Lamb by Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Mary had a little lamb. His face was white as snow, yeah.
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the May 2025 Mojo Magazine, an article about records Dionne Warwick made with Burt Bacharach. Also, an interview with the Pogues making Rum, Sodomy, and The Lash. And a classic album review of the Beastie Boys, Check Your Head. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
What a time did they have that day at school.